Welcome, everyone. We can call this meeting to order, House State Affairs, 3 p.m., Tuesday, February 4th. Madam Secretary, would you mind calling the roll?
Representative Hopkins? Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Price Tompkins?
Here.
Thanks to Representatives Knopp and Josephson for joining us today. Please silence your cell phones. Martha Moore is the House Records Keeper, and the moderator today is Madison Truitt. On the agenda today are two bills, HB 198, Aggravating Factors at Sentencing, presented by Representatives Josephson and Knopp and staff. And after that, we will go to HB 182, Sexual Assault Examination Kits Testing. Both of these are first hearing in House State Affairs, so Representatives Josephson and Knopp, would you like to Representative Hopkins has joined us. Representatives Josephson and Knopp, would you like to introduce your bill?
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy Josephson, House District 17, East Anchorage. For the record, I appreciate your quickly scheduling this bill. It's House Bill 198. It creates a modified statutory aggravator based on gender identity and sexual orientation in the 22nd paragraph of the aggravators. So approximately 32 states in the United States recognize some form of specific legal safeguard within their respective criminal codes for persons of the LGBT community or some subset of the same. So essentially 32 touch on some sort of criminal aggravator in that larger cohort. This is typically done, as I said, by providing a sentencing enhancement or aggravator in cases where the victim was targeted because of their gender identity or sexual orientation status. And we can talk at length about what I mean when I say targeted. It's fairly self-explanatory. This enhanced sentence can be perceived as either a deterrent to misconduct by a perpetrator or protection of same-sex orientation persons, a historically victimized group of Americans. Alaska law lacks any provision offering further deterrence, or some would say punishment, for defendants who target persons based on their gender identity or orientation status. Sadly, it sometimes takes a horrific and unfortunate event, and my colleague, Representative Knopp, will tell you about that event, to engender the support or willingness to provide a public statement in support of enhanced sanctions for the targeting of persons based on qualities inherent in them. And Alaska, as I said, recently experienced that type of incident. Typically, when a person is victimized by a felony outside of any targeting related to their race, sex, disability, or the like, a presumptive statute applies, and the greater society, while angered and frustrated, is not specifically imperiled. And here what I'm referring to is if we all see on the local news or read in the paper that there was an assault, often we ask ourselves, was the person abducted, was the person arrested and detained? And we're relieved when we hear they were. And if you're not in some defined, protected group, you may view it in a certain way as well. That is, if it was a crime of a general nature, not targeting any specific group, then I think the normal human reaction is to say, we have a crime problem, but to be more relaxed, certainly, once an arrest is made. But not suffer the anxiety that goes with realizing the person who was targeted is a person whose group I'm in too. That's the essence of what I'm trying to say. Where there are indications that a subset of society is the intentional target of an attack, that group can feel particularly threatened and with cause. This fact was identified in Wisconsin versus Mitchell by Chief Justice William Rehnquist in support of a holding that hate crimes are constitutional. And interestingly there, that case involved a white victim who was attacked by African-American men or women. I'm going to guess men. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said the legislature can't have a constitutional law that aggravates that sentence. And Justice Rehnquist, who was originally appointed by Richard Nixon and then advanced or promoted to Chief Justice by Ronald Reagan, said you can have that and that hate crimes are constitutional. And I can find you and read you the key language. But essentially, he was concerned about the fact that it could create a state of anxiety that that legislators like ourselves should feel free to protect and respond to and be sensitive to. Presently, there are 37 different types of sentencing enhancements in Alaska law that allow the court to add sentence time beyond the statutory presumptive period. The current 22nd type says that a sentence can be aggravated where a defendant knowingly directed the conduct constituting the offense at a victim because of that person's race, sex, color, creed, physical or mental disability, ancestry, or national origin. So it's that section that would have these five words added to it, sexual orientation or gender identity, right? So if the question is raised, why do we have hate crimes? Almost every state, 45 out of 50, already have them. So 45 legislatures have said, we need these. We're part of that group, but we're not part of the group of 32, if I've got this right, that cover this gender identity and sexual orientation. So I'll speed this up. And at this time, actually, I'll invite Representative Knopp to make a statement. But I'll tell you one other thing that's important to know. The prosecutor, so the crime would be charged in the normal way any crime is charged. The prosecutor would be required, I think, under court rules, to announce that they were going to seek an aggravator, and that would probably almost surely happen after the conviction. It might happen before, but that's all taken care of procedurally. Under federal Supreme Court decision, in most instances, not in every instance, but in most instances, the same 12 jurors that said, Defendant Smith committed this crime, whatever the crime is, it's got to be a felony, those same 12 jurors must remain in their seats to determine whether beyond a reasonable doubt an aggravator has been proven. And I think there's some concern that if a defendant, for example, were African American, it must be true that the defendant was targeted because they're an African American. The response to that is absolutely not. You have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that there was some hostility or hatred of that targeted person. So I'll turn this over at this point to Representative Knopp to describe why specifically this has come up.
Thank you, Representative Joseph Sun and Co-Chair Field and Committee. Thank you for hearing the bill. And for the record, I am Representative Gary Knopp, representing District 30. A little background. So this incident that prompted us here today did happen in my community, and I didn't know when I crafted the bill that Representative had also crafted the bill. Alleged legal don't tell us that till they rolled out on pre-file date. Since we had two bills that were identical in nature, it made sense to combine them, and that's what we did. And there's not a better representative to speak to the legalities of this bill than Rep. Josephson, so I appreciate him being involved in this. But for me, it was quite an education, and so I had no idea how much the LGBT community is growing. It's not a narrowly defined group of people. I mean, it's pretty broad all over the state. I didn't know this, and when this type of incident happens in your community, it kind of gets personal. And it really got personal for me when I was invited to attend a town hall meeting in regards to this. And when I was expecting 20 to 30 people, I had 200 people in that. And not all members of the LGBT community, but definitely supporters of the community and the folks in that community. So their request was to expand the aggravators, make this hate crime and that gender identity and sexual orientation. And in this case, we have a lady, Tammy Wilson, who was, you know, as the representative may have mentioned, may not, that's in some notes I have. So what makes this a targeted hate crime, in my opinion, although the gentleman hasn't been arrested, convicted, is the fact that three incidents happened in a very short time frame. First, a homophobic note on a vehicle. A few days later, the windshield being smashed in by a very large boulder, not just the windshield, but the front end of the car. And a lot of damage. And then third, shortly after that, was the attack on her home by knife and cut her up pretty severely. And I got to see the photos of her in the hospital bed with stitches up and down her arms and throughout her body. So, you know, it's definitely somebody who's full of hatred, and that's what we don't want to happen. When I read the statute and I see that how much has to be proven, I mean, the prosecutor has a huge hurdle before these aggravators can be applied, and Representative Jolson has the ability to speak to them. But it's so at the request of the community, I brought this forward. I felt like it was the right thing to do. And I want to make it really clear. People said you're creating a new class of people, you know, a special protected class of people. And I say, you know, it's the same protection we extend to any class of people. And when statute says you're prohibited from these types of crimes based on race, sex, religion, mental, physical disabilities, numerous things, this is just another component. And I expect as we progress through time, you will at some point in our history see some more issues added to this statute. So, I'll just touch briefly on a bill we talked about last year, the discrimination bill. It did the same thing. We don't discriminate in this day and age for any reason, you know. And so it was an attempt to add similar discrimination measures that failed. But the last thing I want to say is that this is a good bill. It's a good process what we're trying to do here. But some people just don't like the LGBT community. And we're okay with that. We're not asking you to like the LGBT community, even like what they stand for, what they do. I don't particularly like the gay pride parades, but I do advocate for them to have the same protection any other individual is entitled to. So as we go forward and we debate this legislation, I ask you to remember that's really what we're trying to do, is just extend the same protection to every group there. So, and again, I want to thank you for hearing the bill. So, Representative.
So I thank you, and you know, fundamentally, the way I view this bill
is, it is going to be very uncommon. We could ask the Department of Law, for example, how often subparagraph 22 of the 37 or 38 aggravators is sought for an increase in the presumptive term, right? So judge says, all right, I've got a range of 2 to 4 years for this B felony, and I find you guilty, the jury did, and I'm going to sentence you to 3 years. However, one of these aggravators applies, it's now 3.5 years or 4 years. Probably the use of this 22nd paragraph, where someone was targeted because they are Cuban, or they were targeted because they're African American, or because they're disabled, is very uncommon, and that's cause for celebration. So this would also be uncommon, but you need it when you need it. Because if you don't have it, then you're effectively saying, this is just a typical assault, when it's not a typical assault. And like is so common in the criminal code, the facts tell us as best they can what was going on in the mind of the assailant or the offender. The criminal code already does that in virtually every instance. That's why we take someone who meditated and, or didn't, but basically someone who pre-planned a homicide weeks in advance, we treat that more severely than someone who did it in a state of impassioned fury. Those are different things. And here you're talking about the targeting of someone in a very deliberate way, systematic way. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, and then my staff has a presentation, a short one to make for you.
Do members have questions? I've just got one question for Representative Knopp. Representative Knopp, could you talk about the city of Soldotna passing a resolution in support of this bill?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields, and again for the record, Representative Kerry Knopp. Yes, the city of Soldotna did pass a resolution in support of this, and I guess I should say at that meeting of approximately 200 people was many elected officials there from mayors to council members from both cities, assembly members were there, a lot of public officials and broad support. And I can tell you, Co-Chair Fields, that the city of Kenai has a resolution in front of them that they will be dating tomorrow in support of this bill as well. So, but the city of Soldotna has passed a resolution of support. So.
Okay. Well, I guess if other committee members, okay, Representative Vance.
Thank you. I have a few questions on adding this. So we already have in our statutes that we can't discriminate, and this is more directly the defendant knowingly directed the conduct constituting the offense at a victim because of, you know, person's race, sex, color. Why does sexual orientation or gender identity that has to do with sexuality not fall under the definition of sex as it already is included in statute?
Well, through the chair, Representative Vance, it's a good question. What I would say is that this very issue is before the United States Supreme Court now. You know, that may beg the question, well, why don't we wait to see what they do? Here I'm referring to, I think, discrimination statutes, and I'm trying to remember the details of the case, but essentially it was the Obama administration's position that the term sex would indeed represent what you're talking about, that it could be incorporate gender identity and sexual orientation. The Trump administration has said it absolutely doesn't. That's the essence of a dispute, and the dispute before the Supreme Court that's pending is not about a criminal matter. That's number one. But I would say this, in a criminal case, the standard for defending an appellate review would be stricter, right? So if I were a defendant and this aggravator were imposed and the prosecutor said, well, Your Honor, Josephson must have done this based on sexual orientation and it fits neatly into sex, the sex clause, I would challenge that, and I bet I'd prevail. And I bet I'd be able to say, since what's at issue is my liberty, the court's going to read that pretty narrowly, our appellate court, and they're likely to say, that is not what that is. And so I think that, this is long-winded, but essentially Ms. Willis would not see her assailant suffer any additional sentence with what we have now.
Follow up?
Yes.
Well, since this is attempted to be narrowly defined by the courts, what is the definition? I didn't see a definition added in the statute for sexual orientation and gender identity, because clearly when it comes to male and female, we can biologically identify. So how can we add a definition for statutory and legal reasons to sexual orientation and gender identity for this statute?
Through the chair, I would look to see, and I can do it now because I know the definitions always occur at the end of the title, whether, for example, there are definitions of creed, physical or mental disability, et cetera. I think what I'm going to find is that there aren't. And so one answer is that's burdensome. It's arguably doable, but it's going to be provocative. Now, we shouldn't shy away from provocative things, but it's going to needlessly delay the movement of the bill in a way that I think misses the point. So what we're talking about is what's in the mind of the defendant. It's less important whether someone truly was, for example, a same-sex-oriented person. What's important is if the defendant believed they were. And so I don't know. And I would also say there are many instances, and I've read these I can count them. But you can find, if you simply go to the Alaska Court System database and you enter in the search engine Webster, it'll have scores of hits where the Supreme Court literally goes to the dictionary to say, this hasn't been defined, we'll figure out what was intended. And they'll apply some logical definition. You could offer, assuming the committee wants to take this up and mark it up and amend it, you could offer a definition, but I just don't think it's required.
follow-up? It would seem that if we are going to be imposing this upon our citizens who are in a jury, that we should narrowly define the parameters of what they are supposed to be assuming a person is believing or thinking in their mind. I think that's a heavy burden that we put on top of our citizens, and it's our job as the legislature to provide the scope of what this piece of legislation's intent is.
We have another question too. Do you want to respond to that or just go on to another question?
I'll take another question.
Okay. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. And maybe I'll find this in the article. Representative Knopf, do you remember the Facebook post that came out during the time of the attack about what the note left on the victim's car said?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, you know, I've read that note two or three times. I don't remember the detail, but something about, how do you put this on the record? How do you say this? What was read on that note? But it definitely made reference to her sexual orientation.
It did not make reference to her gender in this case.
It was the sexual orientation.
It was clearly dealing with the sexual orientation, right? So not the sex. So including this language in there would be somewhat critical to making sure that the intent of the person is clear, because it's not get out of town woman, it was get out of town you lesbian or something along those lines, with a lot of other hateful words mixed in there.
And exactly right. That's exactly what it's saying. And so if I may just respond a little bit, Mr. Chair, to Representative Vance's. So in the attorneys I talked to seeking their opinion in this, and it wasn't a written opinion, just conversation. But so I said, well, we already have sex in there. And they said, yeah, if I hate you because you're a woman, or you hate me because I'm a man, that applies. But if I hate you because you're a gay woman, that's a whole different, you know, I don't necessarily hate women, but I hate you because you're a gay or you're a gay man, you know, then I don't necessarily hate men, but I do, when, you know. And the same thing applies for transgender people. I don't necessarily hate women, but I hate women who's had a transgender operation to become a man. So, you know, and so that was, you know, and I'm going to say that I somewhat had the same conversation you just brought up, and they were saying that's the difference. You don't necessarily hate a sex, but you do when they modify their behavior in that sense. And so that was the reason for needing a sexual orientation in that aspect of things. So you know, you go to intent, you know, the guy, an individual, doesn't mind women, but you see two of them together, and then he has a hatred for, and he acts on that, you know. And it's not just a single act, it's repeated, same act, you know, and that he wouldn't necessarily do against any other male or female, you know.
And I think Representative Joseph.
Thank you. I want the record to be clear on this matter. So, as I said, the definitions follow the chapter, and chapter 1255-185 says, in this chapter, well, the chapter is the second set of numbers, that's 55. In this chapter, unless the context requires otherwise, and it defines a bunch of terms. And I look at these terms and I say, all right, does it define race? No. How about sex? No. How about color, creed, physical or mental disability, ancestry or national origin? No. So, again, this statute, I don't know for sure how long we've had Section 22, but you can bet it's a long time, because we now have 37 or 38 aggravators. And so they keep them in order, right, chronologically. So I'm going to say this one has been around decades. And there's been no problem with needing to define those terms that's been brought to my attention. So I would say, that it's unnecessary to define these terms. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, reading about this incident is just horrifying, and I think gets at what Representative Josephson talked about with being motivated by hate. I mean, to stalk someone and assault them like that. Wow. if other committee members don't have questions, I guess we could go to the staff president. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, the sponsors. I was curious, I mean, to Representative Vance's question, it seems as though there might be a doubt in her mind whether the incident in Soldotna was or was not motivated by hate relating to sexual orientation or gender identity. Given the definitions on the books, would Department of Law Criminal Division be able to weigh in whether the current hate crime laws would encompass this incident? I can just say your reading is very similar to my reading, that they would not encompass it, but to assuage doubts that might exist in people's mind, has that consultation happened?
That consultation has not happened, but again, it's 32, 32 states have, yes, 32 states have adopted similar measures. So, you know, is it worth our double checking? Sure. But you can imagine that those 32 states went through similar discussions. Okay. And it's noteworthy, by the way, I don't have my op-ed here, but it's noteworthy that there were six or seven, and I hate to use the term, but very red states that protect this class of persons. Now, understand, they're not getting protected. They're actually getting, in some cases, viciously assaulted or even murdered. And you will see that the FBI hate crimes data supports that it's the LGBT community, more sadly, more than any other community, by percent, that is victimized. Okay, so when I say, when you hear the word protection, you think, oh, this is a special privilege. Well, yes, if you're assaulted or murdered or otherwise victimized by a felony. So it's not a category to begrudge. It's a category to protect. Because the targeting of someone in that way, there's always going to be crime. And if it's a generic sort of general crime, we apply a presumptive sentence. But for decades, starting in the 60s, we've said, under what I'm not crazy about the term, but under the term hate crimes, we're going to enhance sentences if you're bringing a certain animus, because that animus hurts everyone in the society in a unique way.
I think Representative Story had a question, and Representative Shaw.
I was just going to make a comment and thank both of you for bringing this forward.
And Representative Shaw.
Representative Joseph, you mentioned that there are 37 aggravating factors that are on the books presently. And if we look from a perspective of a hate crime, there could be 100. And there's a potential that any crime to anyone could be hateful. And it could be regarded as a hate crime. Social interaction between families. A husband kills a wife and a child. He does it out of anguish, out of potentially hate. So when do we stop adding to the aggravating factors and not just say a hate crime could very well be attached to literally any crime in some respect?
Through the chair, I bet, and I haven't read, I've read all the aggravators many times, but I bet I could find someone that would, something, a paragraph, that might just cover the facts you suggested. And, in other words, a domestic violence-related offense. But here's my answer. And I've been trying to think of a way to say this that doesn't engender some sort of prejudice or unfair comment. If we think about tall red-haired men, okay,
not now, short red-haired men.
Tall red-haired men, there's no history. I suppose you could talk about the 1850s in New York City and Tammany Hall's dislike of the Irish immigrants, and you could get into sort of red hair questions. But this is not frivolous. If you are a 6'6" red-haired person, man, you are not going to be targeted because you're 6'6" red-haired person. It isn't, isn't going to happen. And that's why this other carve out in paragraph 22 evolved, because the facts are in. The facts are in that in these other groups, you very well might. And don't forget that Justice Rehnquist, now there's real irony here. I don't know if he knew what he was unleashing, okay? But Justice Rehnquist in 1993, a very conservative justice, said, by God, Wisconsin can protect that white victim from those assailants who happen to be African American, and where there was evidence that they attacked that white man because he was white. And they can enhance that sentence.
And I might interject, because the Irish example is really interesting. I mean, 100 years ago, Irish people were not considered white. So, in fact, a crime against an Irishman because they were Irish, I think, had these laws been in place, could have been considered a hate crime. Of course, now we consider Irish people white. But actually, the trend is in the opposite direction, toward having fewer groups excluded as different. And that's a good thing, that we are including more people as normal. Just, I guess, my short take as a Scotch-Irishman. Should we do the staff presentation?
Yes, please.
Okay. And someone referenced the note on the windshield, so I'm just going to pass them around for people who are unfamiliar with it and want to get a sense of just how vicious this the stalking was before the attack.
You may see, just quick interruption, that former U.S. Attorney for the State of Alaska, Ms. Leffler, is on the line.
And my intention was to go ahead and take her comments as public testimony after the staff presentation, if that's okay with the committee, and we will have more public testimony on Thursday.
Co-Chair Fields, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present today. For the record, my name is Nathaniel Grabman, staff to Representative Josephson, and a lot of the material in this will have already been covered in some way, so I will try to make it brief. All right, so this bill deals with aggravating factors in sentencing. Broadly speaking, let's just like to reiterate that these aggravating factors come into play when a defendant has already been sentenced. They aren't particularly relevant before that point occurs. You then have these 37 separate factors that are in statute. If they're proven in the court, then they shall be considered at sentencing, and that you can add time to a sentence. There were also mitigating factors in statute. When you put those together, there's the potential for the sentencing for any given crime to be above or below the presumptive range, which is also laid out in statute. Question, why do we have these aggravating factors in the first place? Broadly speaking, we as humans recognize that a lot of things that we do or say occur in like shades of gray. It's not always black and white. So motive and details, those are important. Pretty much all laws are a reflection in some way of societal attitudes, and we have decided as a society that we do not want to condone certain bias-motivated attacks on individuals or groups. And broadly speaking, these attacks, that sort of thing, can be viewed as particularly abhorrent or aberrant to society writ large. HB 198 would amend aggravator 22. As we said, there's this list of categories that already apply, and it would add sexual orientation or gender identity to that list. This is some data that I found from the FBI. They come out with a report every year. As you can see, bias-motivated attacks against people because of their sexual orientation has been trending upwards for the last 4 years, for which you have data. When we're talking about gender identity crimes, it was relatively flat, and then there was a roughly 30% spike in the last year that we have data. We often say that things might be happening nationally, but what about Alaska? As Representative Knopp laid out and the articles talk about, some events happened on the Kenai Peninsula. These are just some headlines from that series of events.
Mr. Grabman, I think Representative.
I'm sorry.
I have a clarification question on the FBI page. Is this U.S. statistics or Alaska?
These are U.S. statistics. The last slide in the presentation has a link to a video, which, depending on how the committee feels, we can or cannot watch. It's about 3 minutes, and it at one point talks about the inadequacy of some of these statistics and why it's thought that these numbers are quite underreported.
Follow up. And this is just, this is by 100. There's no scale on here.
Correct. The numbers you see are, the numbers you see are what has been reported to the FBI.
So the
events in Soldotna, from the time of that note to the time of the resolution in support by the Soldotna City Council was a matter of months, so fairly condensed time frame. And then finally, this is just a map of laws that are existing nationwide. There are, depending on how you define it, there are 4 to 5 states that don't bother to have any aggravators on their books. Wyoming, Arkansas, South Carolina, Georgia, and potentially Indiana. That one's kind of back and forth. There's some argument there. So basically about 2/3 of the states that have these laws have aggravators, generally have some protections for these classes. And then if you'd like to watch this video, we can, or we can hold off.
I think it's useful. I will preface it by saying one might watch this and say, well, it looks like this matter's covered by federal law. It's not covered by federal law. It's partially covered by federal law. But, for example, in the facts that occurred in Sterling, the assault occurred in her garage or right as the garage door was present. And there's no federal nexus there. That's the key term. And a former AG for the state, Ms. Leffler, for the U.S. Attorney, rather, U.S. Attorney for the state of Alaska, will describe that in more detail. Thank you. In the event we are fortunate enough to see this bill move out of committee, we will work on that audio. But this was just a CNN 3-minute production from just about a few days ago in response to a hate crime that occurred in the lower 48.
Great, thank you. So at this time, let's go to Karen Leffler. Ms. Leffler, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm online, thank you.
Okay, please proceed with your testimony.
Okay, I'm not going to take a lot of your time, and thank you for inviting me. I'm Karen Leffler. I was a 30-year federal prosecutor and finished as a U.S. attorney. I want to echo something that Representative Josephson said, and that is that the first line and the protector of our community members against these types of assaults is the state. The federal government has civil rights laws, but they are really secondary by far to the state laws. They involve situations where individuals, because of their status, are attacked while they are engaged in and enjoying certainly federal protected activities, which just really limits it. The primary people that protect against attacks based on your status and race is the state. The second thing I wanted to say is that it is very common for judges to take into account the motivation of somebody, both as a mitigator and as an aggravator. And the reasons are pretty basic. It's abhorrent to our society, or in state law, it's a condemnation of community consciousness to attack somebody solely because of their status. And unfortunately, in this case, not only in Alaska, but it was true also federally before, that there were no special protections for people who were attacked solely because of their, whether it's their gender identity or whether they identified themselves as their sexual orientation, gay or whatever. The federal government changed that in 2009 with the Shepard-Byrd Act, which added protection for sexual orientation, and it was based on an attack on an individual. If I recall, it was in Montana. And it's often that's how we fill things. But the other thing to think about is, I'm very proud as an Alaskan that we're a very inclusive community. But people that choose to attack somebody that they may not even know solely because of who they are or some specific characteristic are simply more dangerous to our society. It's not an unlikely thing to say, you know, we both condemn this because it didn't have to do with the situation. And also it is more dangerous in the future. If you're going to say those people that are not like me, I'm going to stalk. So I support this law as filling a hole, but unfortunately we became aware of the hole because of specific actions. But it is simply, it's filling a hole that the federal government filled in 2009 based on a horrific incident. And hopefully, and in my experience, these statutes are rarely used. But when this type of thing happens, we need them to be there. And that's really all I have to add, unless anybody has any questions for me. Thank you.
I have a question, Ms. Leffler. So Representative Vance asked earlier about listing sex versus sexual orientation and gender identity. And you know, as a former prosecutor, could you talk about why that more comprehensive definition makes a difference in terms of prosecuting hate crimes?
Yes. And, you know, I'm not generally these aren't defined within the statute, but there's a difference between somebody's sex attacking me because I'm female, and that may not cover somebody where you're not attacking them because you're female, but you're attacking them because of gay. That is not, I mean, many of our population that are, you know, gay, they're male or female gay, they don't dispute their sex. You know, they're male and their partner's a male. They're female, their partner's a female. If you attack them because of their sexual orientation, you're not attacking them because of their sex. And there would still be a hole there.
Thanks for that clarification. Do other committee members have questions for Ms. Leffler? Okay. So we will hear HB. Thanks, Ms. Leffler, for calling in and for sitting through the whole presentation.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
We will hear this bill again on Thursday, February 4th, and have an opportunity for public testimony. If you'd like to submit an amendment, the deadline is Wednesday, February 3rd by 5 p.m. At this time, again, the 5th, by 5 p.m., thank you. Thank you again to Representative Joseph Knopf for coming in and for working on this legislation, and we're going to hold it until Thursday. At this time, we're going to take a brief at ease and come back for HB 182, sexual assault examination kits testing, and I know a couple members have to leave to go to Southeast Conference. Okay, back on the record, House Bill 182, sexual assault examination kits testing, introduced by Representative Tarr. Thank you, Representative Tarr, for being here. This is the first hearing in House State Affairs. And do I have a motion to adopt the sponsor substitute for discussion before us today?
Mr. Chair, I move the committee adopt the sponsor substitute is our working copy for House Bill 182. And the sponsor substitute is Work Order 31-LS1188/M.
Okay, seeing no objections.
I object for purposes of discussion, please.
Okay. You mean for discussion of the bill, Representative Vance?
Or this amendment.
Of the sponsor substitute. Okay. I'm going to take a brief piece. Substitute and hear a presentation from Representative Tarr on her bill, HB 182.
Thank you so much, Mr. Co-Chairs, for the opportunity to present this bill to you today. This is a topic we've talked about before in this committee, and so I just wanted to, with the time we had today, kind of spend it just spending a brief minute doing a little bit of the context of the work that we're working on, and then where we are today, and then what today's bill does, and kind of just focusing in on the timing aspect of it. And so just for sort of the brief history context was, in the fall of 2014, I had received a letter from the End the Backlog organization, which is a project of the Joyful Heart Foundation that's listed here. The Joyful Heart Foundation was founded by Mariska Hargitay. She's the actress who plays the female detective on the Special Victims Unit, the crime show, yes, the longstanding crime show. And what was happening through her work was that she was receiving a lot of communications from individuals who'd been victims of sexual assaults, and these people were asking for her help. And of course, she's an actress, not a public safety official. And so she was trying to figure out, you know, what could she do with all this information? And she became very motivated to work on this issue. She founded the Joyful Heart Foundation, and then specifically their End the Backlog initiative to end the backlog of untested rape kits. And the reason it's exciting to share sort of just this context and historical frame for all of you is, so often Alaska is like the lowest on the list or the last to do something, but we are actually making significant gains here in the reforms. And so I just wanted to point out sort of their pillars. That's what I started working from back in 2014. And identify them: the annual statewide inventory, the mandatory testing of backlog kits, the mandatory testing of the new kits, a statewide tracking system, victims' rights to notice, and then the funding for the reform. And what is very exciting is to look at where we are. We have accomplished almost everything on that list. That is very exciting for me, because it means that we've done significant reforms, and you know, these are the people who spent a lot of time figuring out how to make it work better. So we have, through two different pieces of legislation, established the statewide audit requirement. So we are getting those, and the document I passed out is the last 3 years of the statewide audit numbers, so that's good. We have a victim-centered approach to reporting. We have established the tracking system. So if you think of just like a mail package or UPS, right, we have a tracking system and chain of custody system now for all rape kits from the time they are used to, you know, going to the crime lab and that whole process. We have achieved through the bill last year this part, the victim's right to notice. We require now that victims be notified by public safety in, officials within 2 weeks of their rape kit being tested. That piece, some states have done a bit more of a comprehensive approach, so more like an online tracking system so an individual can go log in and track it. And, you know, what we're trying to do is, as we have funds available, kind of bring in these pieces of the reform. So that has come with a bit of a hefty price tag. So we've accomplished the victim's notice through the requirement that law enforcement get in touch with them, but we don't have the you know, full tracking system. So that's the one piece where we kind of haven't done all of these reforms. But we have worked really hard, and I'm very excited that we're at this place where, having gotten all those other reforms done, now we're looking at how do we really address the timeline. And we have a sponsor substitute before us today. The original bill, and I want to kind of get us into the thinking of this. When I started working on this, it was taking a little more than 2 years on average for a kit to be processed. And as, you know, we've worked through this in capacity and training and funding, we got down to about a year. And then this fall, the crime lab offered a tour, and we're going to hear from the crime lab director, and want to just say really positive things about them. And we talked about what might the best case scenario be for, you know, the best timeline we could achieve. And that's where the 60 days came from. And, you know, just want to talk through, when we look at the fiscal note, sort of what that means. But, you know, we were trying to work towards sort of what would the best practice be for Alaska. So that's where the 60 days came from. And so really just want to focus in, you know, the single piece that this bill is addressing is the timing. And I just want to use this Alfonso Mosley case as sort of the case study for this. And you notice up here, they had his DNA evidence, but because of delay in processing, he was still out on the streets, and then a fourth woman was raped. And this one, you know, when people say what keeps you up at night, this sort of set of sentences here really, really gets to me. The effect on the victims cannot be overstated. Some of these women waited years to find out who their assailant was. One woman moved back to her hometown out of fear and shame. One of these women, after years of suffering from infertility, despite her best efforts with her partner, became pregnant as a result of the rape. The cruel irony of carrying the child of her rapist after years of trying to have a child with her partner had a significant impact on her. For each of these women, they relived the trauma of the rape and recently endured having to tell a grand jury what happened to them. And to me, this is just, if this were the only thing that happened in Alaska in a single year, it would be so unacceptable. But it is just one of so many stories like this. And what we're really learning is the power of the timing of getting this work done. And, you know, in this case, you know, because we didn't move quickly, a fourth woman was raped. And that's what the delay in timing means. And so, my position, right, you know, why we bring this to you is that we need to do better. And I want to pull us to the fiscal note now. And it's a hefty fiscal note. And kind of walk through this and then ask the director of the crime lab to fill in a little bit for me. But one of the things that people may be aware of is we have a great facility in terms of the crime lab, but we never fully staffed it up so that we had the in-state capacity to do all of the forensics processing necessary. Our crime lab right now is really processing as much as they can for all of the state, although in some circumstances things have to be sent out of state. But what we've learned as we work through this is it's a big uplift to get these highly qualified technical staff in place. So, for example, in House Bill 49, when we put in the one-year timeline, from the time the funding became available, it took a few months for the position to be created, then several more months for it to be advertised, recruited, and a person, you know, offered the position and hired. And then when they bring somebody on, there's about another year and a half of training to really get them up to speed because of all the requirements. You're dealing with evidence. And so there's just, you know, kind of the there's a very specific process and training that needs to be involved. And there's just not a great number of those individuals in Alaska, so hiring from outside and can be challenging. So what is happening is just even when we're funding a new position, it's a bit of a delay before it's created, advertised, and someone is successfully hired and trained. And so the new leadership, I just want to give compliments to Mr. Canaris. He's online and going to fill in some things here, but very impressive. The tour we had of the crime lab was excellent. He's just going above and beyond trying to look at how the crime lab can work better. So they're doing everything on their end. And, you know, for us, it's really about us providing additional resources so they can scale up their operations to meet any new requirement we give them. What we discussed at this time, although our goal is the 60 days, is that the next realistic step is probably 6 months. And that's because given the challenge of getting these positions in place and evolving our system, they think they'll be better able to assess what additional resources will be necessary to meet 60 days once they get to the 6 months, if that makes sense. So kind of get to 6 months and plateau there, and then we'll be able to reassess and go to that last phase for the best practices for Alaska. But they feel like at this time, trying to estimate that entire journey is not an easy kind of path forward, not to see how exactly that would work. So, you know, the estimates in this fiscal note sort of take into account that they really see this as actually being multiple phase. And so I wanted to take that opportunity for us to just think about that because, you know, whoever continues and as we continue this work and we're thinking about it, we want to talk about, you know, having public safety and what that means. And I just thought it was important that we sort of look at the cost associated with that. When I put out the bill in October and said I'd pre-file the bill for 6 months, the response from Alaskans was 6 months is unacceptable. Why not 30 days? Why not 2 weeks? So as, you know, this information became available, it still seemed like it's worth talking about this so, you know, Alaskans can understand, you know, this is a journey that we have to get to. And it takes some financial investment. And then we have to get those qualified staff. We have to keep them in Alaska. One great thing is there's some talk of strengthening the relationships with local law enforcement as this capacity is increased at our state crime lab. You know, better response will just mean improved public safety for the whole state. I'm excited about this leadership, what I saw when I was at the crime lab, and really excited about the potential we have with keep pushing on this process. The handout I gave was from the presentation that they did this fall, and it just shows you the numbers from the statewide inventory so you can see where we started out with the 3484 and then now we're down here at the 1696. I'm not going to steal Mr. Canaris's thunder because I know he actually has a number that's smaller than that, even more updated based on the work they were able to complete throughout the rest of the year. So he's going to fill in a little bit on that. But the thing I wanted to end with, if I could, and I hope the sound will work okay, is just the trailer from this movie, I Am Evidence, and it's a documentary, this is just the under 2 minute trailer, but the piece that we're dealing with, everybody knows about sexual assault as a problem, but specifically what we're dealing with in this particular bill is the timing. And I think this clip just gives you a sense of what happens when there's delay in processing these kids.
Feel free to turn those speakers toward us. Perhaps that would help a little bit.
Demonstration of how we regard these crimes.
You're a rapist.
who were not caught. I can't understand what was so unimportant about me.
Who were you wearing that particular morning?
What they see doesn't look like a male victim. Violence against women is a low priority. All of these kids are tested. There are rape kits that haven't been processed across this nation.
And this kid starts getting assaulted every day. We get another 20 to 30 hits.
Over 700 identified civil rapists. Just in one city, in one county, in one state.
Of course we made mistakes. We didn't realize potential.
You can't change or fix what happened to one person. What you can change is what might happen to someone else.
When you get that list of names and it just scrolls down and it doesn't stop, this is something where we can't rest.
You don't tell me what I can and can't do. It's all it takes is focus, dedication, and commitment.
The system should be more accountable. I am evidence that this is not just a kid. This is a person.
So I have an HBO subscription if anybody wants to watch that documentary. I'd be happy to show it. But for me, when I think about this, you know, when we started out the 3,484 untested kits, you know, that's a sort of separate issue we're dealing with. But just on an annual basis, we have about 1,100 kits that get processed. And I've done a lot of teaching over the years, so I'm always trying to put numbers into, like, the number of students that fill a gym or something. And when I think about the 3,484, that's all of the students at West High School, all of the students at Sitka High School, all of the students at Lathrop High School, and 70% of the students at Homer High School. So it just, like, that is so many lives impacted. I think my role here, you know, I don't think of this as my bill. I really think that the legislature is doing this work together because people are voting for these bills unanimously. We're voting for the budget that includes the funding. And I think I'm just sort of facilitating the process. But this is an issue that impacts every one of our constituents and every district across the state. And so I'm hopeful that we'll continue to push forward and making gains this year like we have over the past few, and really appreciate your time and attention for today's meeting.
Thanks. And should we go to Mr. Canaris now? Okay. Mr. Canaris, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Please proceed with your testimony.
For the record, I'm David Canaris, chief of the Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Lab. And so you just wanted to have an overview of what's happening at the crime lab currently, is that correct?
And I think specifically, you know, how do we work toward the goal of a two-month deadline for testing the sexual assault kits?
Yeah. I am looking at the processes within the crime lab currently. I've taken charge of the crime lab back in July of 2019 with the real goal of reducing backlogs, improving turnaround times, but also beyond that, looking at retention and recruitment, looking at how we develop partnerships with local stakeholders, developing multidisciplinary teams with Department of Law, law enforcement, all of those things. And overall, increasing transparency within the system. I believe Alaska's public has a right to know what's actually happening within the crime lab. We don't want us to be a black box. And so ultimately, I'd like to publish all of this data available, or make it available to the public on the website. Within sexual assaults, what we've seen in the last few years mirrors what goes on nationally. And so we've seen a giant uptick in the amount of cases being submitted to us. With the increased focus and publicity around sexual assaults nationally, with the big sexual assault kit initiative and capital appropriations made available within the state, we've seen more focus on sexual assaults. And then between 2011 and 2017, according to national crime statistics, we also saw an uptick in violent crime rates in the state as well. So overall, that's resulted from 2013 or 2012, when the lab was opened, we had around 300 DNA cases were submitted. Last year, we had 651 cases were submitted, and this year, we're seeing a 33% increase on top of that again, so we're on track for over 900 cases being submitted to the crime lab. Ways we're looking to address that, obviously, more personnel is one way we're approaching that, but it can't be the only way, and so we're looking at certain process changes that we can implement to speed up the process internally. So we're looking at our training program, and how we can make an expedient version of the training program and have certain analysts trained to certain points in the program where they can then report the data much quicker. And so those cases that don't have probative findings can be released much quicker, so the victims can then get that closure much quicker. We can we're going to be implementing that program with the positions that we got during the HB 49 funding last year. Does that kind of give you a flavor of where we're at?
Yes, thank you. Do committee members have questions for Mr. Canaris or the bill sponsor, Representative Thompson?
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Canaris, thank you very much for being online with us today. We have worked over the last few years to try to increase get rid of the backlog of sexual assault kits that have been turned in and not tested. Can you kind of give us a breakdown of where we're at compared to where we were like 3 or 4 years ago? I mean, I'm seeing numbers here, but I don't quite understand them all. And how much progress have we made?
Yes, Representative, through the chair. So the Crime Lab views this as kind of three separate pools of kits that are coming in. And so in 2016, federal funds were made available under the SAARCI initiative. They were directed at testing only the DPS, Department of Public Safety, or Alaska State Trooper kit. So an inventory of those kits was done around the state, of which there was a little under 600 of those. All of those have completed testing right now. That pot of money has been exhausted on all of those kits have completed testing. The following year, the state made a capital appropriation of $2.75 million available for testing all of the other kits in the state. So that's all of the other police departments, including Anchorage Police Department. There's 2,500 of those kits. Of those, 1,290 have been submitted to a third-party testing company, and 1,000 of them we've had results back on so far. The third part is the ongoing cases. So those are the cases that come in as part of our regular casework. That's the number that I was giving in the previous answer, where I said we're going to be on track for around 900 of those this year. Of those, around 60 to 70% of them are sexual assaults, and they will be tested. Currently, our testing is about 9 months. It's the oldest kit that we have in the building, and that's down significantly from where we were 2 or 3 years ago, where we were at 2 years for testing.
Do other committee members have questions? Okay.
Did you have a question?
I have a question about the bill.
Oh, Representative Vance.
Thank you for your work on this. This is something that that all of us want to get behind because it's so necessary, and I imagine that most of us have friends who have been victims of rape, and if we say that we don't, it's because we don't know. My question about this bill is, I imagine we want to get to the 60 days, but the effective date is July 1 of 2020. Is that something that we could amend to be a couple of years out? Because it seems like we're still a couple of years out with the backlog before we get to the ground level of processing them as they come in. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm wondering, what, you know, you're willing to work with based upon the information from the lab, so that we can work with what they're already, you know, the process that they have going.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Vance. Thank you so much for that question, and my apologies that I did not include that. But what we've come up with is, you know, we think is like the realistic sort of time frame is to put the 6 months in for now and have the effective date be July 1, 2021. So that would give them potentially some additional, it would probably require a little additional funding in this fiscal year, but probably only a half or a fourth of that. You know, they need some portion to create the positions. That's why I was sort of giving that timeline. So I think what we would want to do is amend the bill to do the 6 months and amend the effective date to be July 1, 2021. And I hope that wasn't confusing. I hope committee members don't feel like that was a misuse of time. But I thought it would be important to look at that full fiscal note just to get a sense of this whole process, because it's something I've had to learn and understand. Sort of the slow kind of uptake. It's less immediate than we would like sometimes when we fund a position or fund something, and kind of having to understand that, if that makes sense. So that was kind of why I thought there was some value in still having that conversation about the long-term goal of the 60 days, but for now, 6 months with effective date of July 1, 2021.
Follow-up? Have you discussed the timeline on being able to hire qualified people for this position? Because I know that in other areas of public safety, we're having trouble recruiting people, and so it's slowed down our other timelines on other important public safety matters, and that would affect this effective date greatly in being able to meet the goal. So have you had conversations about what they expect for hiring?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, yes, and thank you. Great question. That at first we talked about maybe a January 1, 2021, and then they thought July 1, 2021 for that very reason, to really just make sure you actually had appropriate time for the hiring, the training, because, of course, they can't walk in the door and sort of be a fully operational employee because these other steps have to get them up to speed and certified and everything. And for, I meant to send it out, and I will. And Mr. Canaris, I hope he won't be embarrassed by this, but as I was doing some work on this bill, I pulled up his list of certifications, which is a 5-page document of multiple FBI certification and this forensic certification. And so there's the more I've learned about this, and I've asked them if they would offer another tour of the crime lab last fall for folks who weren't able to attend before, because it was so instructional about all of the different pieces of the forensic works that they do, from firearms to fingerprints to shoe prints to blood analysis to DNA. And so, yeah, I think we've hit that sweet spot with the July 1 date.
Follow-up. Do you know how many, if there's been any prosecutions as a result of these kits now being processed, since we have so many that have finally been processed? Have you received any update?
Mr. Canaris has some information on that, on some that's come back, but some of it is still in process. And it's interesting, through the SACI, the other sort of parallel piece of this, the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative that was the federally funded piece, they did a big evaluation of why kits were or weren't tested before. And a big part of this is establishing best practices for how to make those evaluations going forward to be more effective. Mr. Canaris mentioned that when he was saying if they do the testing and there's not usable evidence, then they could more quickly notify a victim and then sort of bookend that process for them. So so that's I think where things are at this time.
Thanks.
Did that answer your question?
Representative Thompson had a question.
Thank you. I got that answered. I had the same question, as I wanted to know what were the results of catching up, and how many identifications and how many cases have been affected or started. Mm-hmm. That was my question. The same. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Mr. Canaris is still on the line, Mr. Chairman. He might be able to fill in a little more of that on some of that, because it's a criminal prosecution. We don't get the information, and that's one of the reasons the group originally I was going to participate as a member of the group, but because it was dealing with these privileged information for people who are in law enforcement, I couldn't participate. So I don't have as much understanding of that piece of it as I wish I did, but I think Mr. Carneris, if he's able to, might have a little more to share on that.
Yes, Representative, through the chair. So going back to the SACI results, which was the federal initiative, of those 568 cases, around a third of them, 199 of them, had DNA profiles that were available. Of those, 57 of them were entered into CODIS and hit against another crime or a person or individual within CODIS. 51 of those were warm hits, or what we call warm hits. To us, that means it was a known individual, maybe a named individual in that case, and 6 of them were cold hits, so they were completely new information to the law enforcement agency. I believe of those, one of those cases is going forward with an active case with Department of Law. I have less information about the CAFTL results. Of those 2,568 of them, 1,000 of them have been tested. This data is probably a little bit out of date, but around 212 as of November had a profile that was available to be uploaded into CODIS. So we usually operate in around a third of those cases have a usable DNA profile. And then it becomes a question of further investigation, and the onus is on the law enforcement agency to go away and do that. What I can tell you is from a federal needs assessment was published in November of last year, and they cited a whole bunch of different research that had been done. A paper was also published in 2019, which looked at the societal benefits or the return on investment from a sexual assault kit. And they estimate that the benefit to society from testing one sexual assault kit is $130,000, which is an 8,000% return on investment.
Representative Hopkins had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tarr, on the second page of the report from the end of backlog on Alaska, on the second page it says, do we currently track rape kits? And it says no tracking system currently exists. Can you describe to me what that tracking system is, or maybe it's a better answer question for the voice in the sky?
Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, I can start out, and then please, Mr. Canaris, if there's more to add. But what I was surprised to find out when we first put in the first bill on this back in 2015 was that we didn't have a system where the kits had a unique identifier. So all of them were prepared in Anchorage, but say 200 of them were sent out to the Bethel Police Department, there was no way to know whether those were used, unused, sitting on a shelf. So now that was identified as a problem. We didn't have to address that legislatively. They changed their operations internally. And so just like a UPS package now, you know, each one has a unique identifier. And then we know from the point it left the crime lab in Anchorage, you know, where it went. And, you know, we always should be able to have that chain of custody to know, you know, it's at this, or it's been sent for testing, or, you know, where it lives. We, in the capital budget a couple of years ago, when we put that funding in for testing, we also put in funding for high capacity storage shelves. So now the crime lab has the ability and the space to be the central repository for all them, so that we don't have the problem of them potentially being, you know, off in locations across the state. Now everything is required to come back to the crime lab. So there's that tracking system of actually the location, but then there's that tracking system for the victim, where the victim would be able to log in and, you know, have that unique identifier, and they would be able to track the kit is in possession of the law enforcement, the kit has been sent for testing to the crime lab, you know, the results are back. They would be able to do that, because one of the challenges with, especially when this takes so long, and if anybody's dealt with a crime, a burglary, anything, you know what this is like, right? You call the police, you get transferred for one person, you get transferred to next, you tell your story five times. Well, that's a little easier to tell if it's your bike was stolen from out front of your house than, you know, I was violently raped. So the idea is that, you know, you don't want to re-traumatize an individual by making that process so difficult. So we haven't fully established the victim tracking in the way that other states have, and that's a piece I would like to get to. But what we have required is at least the law enforcement has to notify the individual within 2 weeks that the rape kit was tested. So they at least have some timelines that are predictable, so it's not so unknown. So now, through the bill we passed last year, it has to be sent to the crime lab within 2 weeks, has to be tested within a year, and then have to be notified within 2 weeks. So that's good. Pardon me, it has to be tested, sent to the crime lab within 30 days. And that was just, again, we were trying to meet like the realistic expectations that the law enforcement agencies told us they could meet with their staffing. So now what would change is that, you know, the requirement to the crime lab within 30 days, then it'd be required to be tested within 6 months, and then the notification within 2 weeks. So again, just adding that certainty in that process so someone knows what's going to happen and when can significantly reduce the trauma of that whole experience. Thank you.
And for committee members, there is a letter from Providence Health and Services about Alaska Cares and improvements in capacity to help survivors of sexual assault and trauma, which does have a bearing on this bill, because it means potentially there's going to be more evidence to examine, and that's in the back of your very thorough materials, Ms. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. In 2018, we appropriated $2.75 million in the state capital budget to get these state rape kits processed. Have we expended all of that money? Because we talked about how long it takes to hire somebody, train somebody. It takes a year. So have we expended all of that money, or where are we in that process?
So through the chair to Representative Thompson, an interesting thing has happened through this process. There's sort of like an industry has developed around testing these rape kits because there were so many untested, and then there were these big sums of federal money became available. So we're not the only state going through this process. And what they're doing right now, you heard Mr. Canaris talk about the kits and them getting sent out. So they're the 2,500 that funding is still available for, he mentioned that about 1,290 of them have been submitted and 1,000 with results. So until all of those have been submitted and tested, we won't sort of have the balance of what remains from that funding. I did see the high capacity shelves at the crime lab, so those have been purchased for sure. But Mr. Canaris, perhaps if there's something I'm missing with that he could help out.
Yes, Representative, through the chair. I think Representative Tarr mainly covered it. None of the funding was going to be used for personnel in state here. We felt like by using it for personnel and training personnel to get up to speed and processing those kits, we would then end up having way too many people for the ongoing amount of work that we had. And so the decision was made a few years back to actually outsource all of those kits to a third-party tester on the East Coast. And so that's where they are. They are around halfway through that testing. We're still seeing kits coming into the lab, which we are then batching up and forwarding on to that agency for testing. And then we're in charge of uploading the profiles into CODIS, the DNA database, at the back end of that.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. You're saying that even a current kit that comes in from the state troopers right now is being packaged up and sent to the lower 48 to be tested, or are you doing those as they come in, and are we then wanting to fund some of the backlog is what we're trying to catch up with? I'm confused on which way we're going here.
Representative, through the chair, no, the cases we inventoried under the capital appropriation, those are the ones that had never been submitted to the crime lab and had been stored locally with police departments around the state. They're the ones that are being outsourced. Anything that's current and is occurring now is going to be tested within the state.
Representative Vance has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a follow-up to the previous question. On the fiscal note, it says that private forensic science service provider could not meet a 60-day testing window. What is the turnaround time for this outsourcing?
Representative Vance, through the chair, we're looking at around 200 days on average for testing to be completed at the private forensic company.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Canaris, in summary, I guess we are expanding our internal capacity while outsourcing some of the backlog. Is that an accurate summary of where we're going?
Representative, through the chair, yes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. If there aren't other questions for the sponsor or Mr. Canaris, Mr. Canaris, thanks again for calling in and for working with Representative Tarr on this bill. We will return to this bill on Thursday, February 6th. The amendment deadline is Wednesday, February 5th by 5 p.m., We will have public testimony on Thursday. And thanks again to House Records Martha Moore and our moderator, Madison Truitt. And with that, we're adjourned at 4:27.